Thank you. Good morning, everybody. How are you? All good? So, well, first of all, I want to say thank you to the organizers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure. First time for me at the Strings Conference, and first time for me at the Perimeter Institute, which I really love. It's beautiful. So thank you. I was asked to give one of the challenge talks, talking about some results and ideas in mathematical physics. And I thought about it, and what I want to start with Richard Feynman. It's always nice to start with a sage and an authority. When he died on February 15th, 1988, in Los Angeles, California, photographs were taken of his blackboard at the time. And they were actually published later in Physics Today. They are in the archive of Caltech, where he worked. And there are many interesting inscriptions you can see. For instance, he says in the left, upper left corner, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." Okay? "I know how to solve every problem that has been solved." I guess not every problem. But what I would like to focus more today is what you see here to the right, where he says, "To learn," in capital letters, "better ansatz problems." Okay? And there is a little arrow here suggesting that kind of that can help us to know how to solve every problem that has to be solved. And just underneath is written "condo." Now, he's not talking about buying a condo in Florida and retire. Okay? He's talking about the condo problem. And spoiler alert, condo problem will appear later in this talk. So in fact, there are some recent works connecting beta ansatz and condo problem, as well as some of the mathematical ideas that I'm going to talk about. So it's actually a giant blackboard, so I'm just showing you some pieces of it. There are some interesting inscriptions here as well. "Physical basis for beta ansatz," he's asking, "is it about variable transformations, such as Turing to Sine-Gordon? Especially, I want to underline KDV." He talks about KDV and modified KDV. Again, something that will appear later in this talk. And then he talks about Gross-Neveu and Ising model, and asks, "Classical soliton relates how to beta ansatz?" Okay? So this is just to set the stage. Now, beta ansatz, what is he talking about? So, as most of you probably know, this is an elegant method for solving quantum mechanical models, which was introduced by Hans Bethe in 1931 in the case of the Heisenberg XXX model, which is one-dimensional spin chain with a space of states which has a spin at every site of the n sites, spin one-half. And Bethe actually proposed an explicit formula for eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian of this model, which worked surprisingly well. It's an explicit formula. You know, usually you don't expect that because it's a humongous space of dimension 2 to the n, and n is very large in general. But the formula works, and if it has certain parameters, and if this parameter satisfies a system of equations called beta ansatz equations, then this is indeed an eigenvector. And after that, this method turned out to be surprisingly efficient in many models. It was applied to many other integrable models, both in quantum mechanics and also two-dimensional QFTs. So the question I would like to ask, why was Feynman so interested in it? Some clues, we can glean some clues from handwritten notes, which are kept at the archive of Caltech, and I had a chance to review them. I can't show them to you because I don't have a permission, but I'll give you a slide, a brief summary of the beginning of the notes. So he gave a Caltech lunch seminar on January 22nd, 1987, about a year before he died, in which he talked about beta ansatz specifically. So many different two-dimensional field theories have been proposed as models to learn from. Sometimes, surprisingly, they can be solved. For example, he gives a list of models where you can, all the familiar models that we know can be solved by beta ansatz. And then he says, mystery, when will it work? Connection to classical solitons. Later in the notes, he mentions quantum KdV, something that will make an appearance later in my talk. There have been some really interesting results in this area in the last few years. Then he asks, why study? Surprisingly, he thinks that this has some bearing, it seems from the notes, some bearing on QCD and formulation of quantum field theory in general. Something to think about. It's almost like he's giving us a challenge here. How can we use Betanzat's ideas for, you know, realistic four-dimensional gauge theories such as QCD? It's a tool useful in other examples. And again, he mentions Kondo problem in his notes. Hello. Know how to solve every problem that has been solved. We've seen that already on the blackboard. And last but not least, he says, fun. So thank you, Richard Feynman, for reminding us why we got into this business in the first place. Because it's fun, right? So let's have some fun. Let me first start by just listing a few works which connect Betanzat's and actually four-dimensional gauge theory, something that you could, you know, loosely call Feynman's dream. Lipatov in 1993 already saw appearance or noticed appearance of XXX model in a calculation of certain scattering amplitudes in QCD. Ludwig Fadeev, who of course was one of the founders of the quantum inverse scattering method, which is was in a way an outgrowth and elaboration on the Betanzat's, wrote a paper about this as well. And then since 2002, we've had sort of an avalanche of works, fascinating works on applications of Betanzat's in NCL4 four-dimensional super young mills, in part in connection with ADS-CFT correspondence. I want to single out in particular the work on what's called the quantum spectral curves by Gromov, Kazakov, Floran, and Volin in 2013. It makes where the so-called QQ system appears. And this is sort of one of our modern ways of encapsulate Betanzat's in a more succinct and productive way. So this will, I will talk about this in a bit. So then the other work, Nekrasov, Shatashvili, Gayota Witten, also some of the people here from the perimeter, Costello, Costello, Witten, Yamazaki, Costello, Gayoto, Yagi, about a version, a connection of a version of a four-dimensional Chern-Simon. So we're getting very close to gauge, four-dimensional gauge theory proper. Connection to integrable systems such as those systems like XXX, XXZ models, and so on. And last but not least, so again, a group of people from here, Gayoto, Levy, Seddon, Wu, connecting Kondo problem and the Gaden model, more specifically, a fine Gaden model, which I will talk about today. It seems like we are, it's like a multi-flying attack on four-dimensional gauge theories. And I think that the field is sort of fertile now to really lead us to some breakthroughs in this area. But let me tell you more specifically about what Betanzat's is. And usually people start with XXX model where it first originated, but I'll start with something even simpler, which is called the Gaudin model, which is a kind of a degeneration of the XXX model. So it also has to do with SL2, but now it's a Lie algebra instead of a Jungian or a quantum group. And so we have, so there's some formulas here. By the way, as usual, I made a lot of slides. I'm a bit worried that I will finish them, but I guess the organizers can always put them later on the website, right? So I shouldn't rush it. Anyway, stop me if you've seen this before, okay? So, or actually, well, raise your hands if you've never seen this before. Okay. Don't be shy. So anyway, basically, you got here, SL2 with the usual generators, Lie algebra SL2, you take the tensor product of finite dimensional representations of SL2. And that's your Hilbert space, your space of states. And this is your Hamiltonian. Actually, not one, but several mutually commuting Hamiltonians. They depend on parameters Zi, which are distinct complex numbers. Okay, so the N operators, and it's basically each operator is like a sum of Casimirs. But these Casimirs are spread out between the I-th and the J-th side. Like so. These are actually the right-hand sides of the KZ equation, so maybe that's an easier way to introduce this. So they commute with each other in the diagonal action of SL2, and we want to diagonalize them. This is a nice playground for Betanzat's. So there is a slight technical point, which is that this actually, because they commute with the diagonal SL2, we can decompose this tensor product into representation of SL2. And so then we can restrict ourselves to just the highest weight vectors, and looking for eigenvectors amongst the highest weight vectors. That was a mouthful. Anyway, this introduces another number, another parameter, lambda infinity, the kind of the highest weight at infinity, which specifies the weight of the eigenvector we're looking at. So now, you can take the tensor product of the highest weight vectors of these representations. It's obviously an eigenvector. And the question is how to construct other eigenvectors. In the simplest case, let's say they're all two-dimensional representations. So at each side, you have spin-up and spin-down bases. So if you take the tensor product of spin-up states, it's an eigenvector. Next, you say, OK, so how about we'll have just one renegade spin, which will go down. So we have a linear combination of states where everybody's up, but one guy is down. But with which coefficients, right? So it looks hopeless to try to find a linear combination which would be an eigenvector. And this is where Betansatz kicks in. We introduce a kind of a lowering operator which kind of spreads out this lowering thing at different sites in a kind of a uniform fashion. It depends on the parameter W, okay? And then we just take the product of these guys. They actually commute with each other in this case, so it's easy. So you got a vector which depends on m parameters, you see? So fi is the lowering operator. So it will transform spin up to spin down. And you have a sum over I, so over all the sides. Okay, so turns out this is an eigenvector if a certain system of equations is satisfied, this system. This is a system on W's, because the I's are fixed and lambda I's are fixed. These are the highest weights, right? Okay, and we can calculate the eigenvalues. And here's something that happens, which is kind of unexpected. If you take, so the Hamiltonians are labeled by integers from 1 to n, so they have eigenvalues labeled by complex numbers from 1 to n, labeled by 1 to n. But it's useful, it turns out to be useful to arrange them, to package them in this weird way as a kind of a rational function which has second order poles at your original, at your points. And then, actually, it's better, so this V, it's actually better to take the second order operator of this form. Miura transformation shows up, which is a splitting of a second order differential operator as a product of first order differential operator. I'm sure most of you have seen this Miura transformation pop up in many different places in math and physics, and this is one of them. It's very suggestive because Miura transformation, we know it connects KdV and MkdV, for instance, right? And so it's actually a Hamiltonian map. It preserves Poisson structures. And so what's going on? Why is it that the eigenvalues of the Gaudin model somehow correspond to this type of operators, okay? It's a nice way, for now, it's just a nice convenient way to package those eigenvalues. It's accessory parameters, what they call, of the second order operators with regular singularities. In modern language, these are called PGL2 or PSL2 opers. Okay, a traditional mathematical term for it is a projective connection. It's actually second-order differential operator, but not acting on functions. It takes those minus one-half forms to three-half forms. And if you arrange it in this way, you can actually, without the choice of coordinates, say that subprincipal symbol vanishes. And in fact, what it is a kind of a classical stress tensor, familiar from CFT. If you calculate its transformation properties, you will see that the Schwarzschild derivative will appear and so on. So now, to summarize, after a little more work, you find that the spectrum of the Gaudin Hamiltonians of our model is going to be given by these SL2 opers on CP1 with regular singularities at the points di, second order, leading terms like so. So and trivial monodromy. So these conditions are, in fact, equivalent to this opera to be representable by as Miura transformation. So see how interesting. We start out with some model which doesn't know about CP1 or any algebraic curves or opers or project connection or whatever, and yet its eigenvalues know about all of this data. What is going on? To look for inspiration, we try to generalize it to other Lie algebras. Okay? So in fact, it's very easy to generalize the Gaudin Hamiltonians by using a bilinear form on G. All right, so again, think of the right-hand sides of the KZ equation. So questions are there any higher order commuting Hamiltonians in general? And is there an explicit formula for the eigenvectors? What are the corresponding beta ansatz equations? Right? Can we describe the spectrum in terms of some classical geometric objects on P1? So it turns out that the answer to most of it is yes. This was actually goes back to my work with Fagin and Richtichen in 1990, published in 1994, so almost 30 years, wow. Okay, so anyway, so here the key idea is that there is a kind of a master algebra which from which all of this Gödel-Hamiltonians emanate. And to understand that, we have to take the Kac-Moody algebra. So we go from G, which is a finite dimensional simple algebra, to the corresponding affine Kac-Moody algebra. It's a loop, kind of a loop algebra, centrally extended. And we look at the center of the enveloping algebra. And the simplest example of this comes from the Shugawara current, which is, of course, familiar from conformal field theory. And the Shugawara, its coefficients have these commutation relations, which shows like if k, the level, is not equal to this weird number called the Dole-Coxeter number, which is n for SLn and so on, then this is non-zero, and you can renormalize it and recover and get the stress tensor. So the Strugawara divided by k plus the Dole-Coxeter number is a stress tensor in a WZW model, say, okay, with Kac-Moody symmetry. But precisely at the critical level, these commutation relations, the right-hand side vanishes, so they become central. So they're central element at this critical level. And in fact, Fagin and I showed that the center is isomorphic to functions on opers, generalizations of the opers that we just discussed for SL2. But now, in general, there's going to be a Langlands duality here. So there's going to be opers corresponding to not the original Lie algebra, but its Langlands dual. Well, at the level of Lie algebras, Langlands dual simply means you exchange B and C, types B and C, which is like SO2n+1 and symplectic. But in fact, there is a deeper thing going on here. This appearance of Langlands dual is not accidental. And what I'm going to argue is that this is a kind of a signature aspect of all the theories that we know that are solvable by beta ansatz. There is a duality going on. And kind of as a preview of sort of like maybe the main message that I would like you to take with you today is that this, I would like to argue that the beta ansatz technique, which, you know, started out, you know, almost 100 years ago as a kind of a clever trick, just write down some explicit formulas. In fact, behind it, there are some very deep dualities of quantum field theory and string theory. Some of them we understand, but many of them we still don't understand. And it would be really nice to be able to connect them to string theory dualities and quantum field theory dualities. Okay? So, okay, well, this is a bit technical, so here I explain more or less how this isomorphism works. For example, for SL2, you have only Shugawara operators, and they correspond basically to the coefficients of this projective connection of this SL2 oper. And in general, these opers for a general group actually were defined by Drinfeld Sokolov in the study of generalized KdV systems. So you see again KdV, not by chance. And Balanced and Drinfeld generalized this to arbitrary Riemann surfaces. And the point is that this algebra of functions on opers has a series of generators which correspond to higher Shugawaras. So indeed, if the Lie algebra, if you go from SL2 to like SL3, you will have two series of Shugawaras of order 2 and order 3 and so on, just like Casimirs in the finite dimensional case. So now, it's possible to construct, actually, and so then this way you construct higher Gödel-Hamiltonians by kind of mapping the center to the algebra which acts on the space of states on the Gödel model. So there is a kind of master algebra behind all of this, which services all Gödel models at once, and this master algebra is the center of the enveloping algebra of the affine Kac-Moody algebra at the critical level. And by Langlands duality, it is actually can be described in terms of classical geometric objects called opers. So that's what happens here. All right? Now, we can construct eigenvectors as well, but unless G is SL2, we may not, in general, get a basis. So somehow the game becomes not so much about constructing eigenvectors, which was sort of Hans Bethe's original guess, but more about describing the spectrum, the eigenvalues, in the dual terms. You see? So that's sort of the, where it's going. And this is where the language duality is manifest. Because remember, in the case of SL2 that I started with, the spectrum was given by this weird things called SL2 opers and on CP1, which had some singularities at the points which were the spectral parameters of the model. But also, there was an additional property that they had trivial monodromy. So that's what happens for a general Lie algebra or Lie group as well. You get, again, LG opers now. Instead of PSL2, you get LG opers on P1 with radical singularities and trivial monodromy. Now, here is already, you can see how S-duality can be useful. So Gaiota and Witten in 2011 interpreted this result using S-duality of four-dimensional super-Young Mills, which we'll discuss in a moment. Okay? I also want to mention that there is a generalization with irregular singularities. These were regular singularities. So it's like second order for second order operator, second order singularity. But you can actually accommodate higher order singularities as well. Before I get to the S-duality, I want to say a few words about the Langlands correspondence. So this is one of the biggest ideas in mathematics, you know, in the last 50 years. You know, about 20 years ago, as a kind of tongue-in-cheek, I said, you know, physicists have their grand unified theories. Well, how come we don't have any? But actually, I said, Langlands program is as good as, you know, is mathematicians' grand unified theory. And I said it kind of as a joke, and it kind of caught on. So now, you can, if you read in Wikipedia, the first paragraph, it says, considered by many as a grand unified theory of mathematics. Okay. So now our grand unified envy to physicists is satisfied. Now we have our own grand unified theory. Of course, it's not a grand unified theory in the sense of unifying all areas of mathematics, which would be impossible. But it does unify quite a bit. In fact, it can be seen in three different domains. And this is in the framework of a beautiful sort of general idea of André Weil, kind of what we call Rosetta Stone of mathematics. Number theory, on one side, Riemann surfaces or curves over complex numbers, on the other side, and then there is an intermediate domain, which are algebraic curves over finite fields. So it turns out that the Langlands correspondence, the Langlands program, can be formulated in each of these three seemingly different domains, and there are many similarities and, you know, analogies between them. So Robert Langlands initially formulated this correspondence in the late 60s in the first two domains, number theory and curves over finite fields. But then later, it kind of propagated to complex geometry, and where it became known as the geometric Langlands correspondence. However, there has been a significant difference between the formulations in this domain, in the first two and the third domain. In the first two domains, it's very, actually, very quantum mechanical, if you think about it. You have a Hilbert space, which are actually functions on a certain natural discrete set with a measure attached to a reductive algebraic group, and a family of commuting operators called Hecke operators. They are generalizations of the classical Hecke operators from the theory of modular forms. And the Langlands correspondence aims to describe the joint spectrum of these operators and to formulate the result in terms of the Galois group of the original field that we work on with, you know, that we work with, and the Langlands dual group. That's where the Langlands dual group first appeared. On the other hand, in the geometric Langlands correspondence, we have a Riemann surface now, and not a number field or not a curve over finite field. And the traditional formulation has been to consider, instead of functions, okay, or space of functions, a category of sheaves on a certain moduli space. And instead of Hecke operators, Hecke functors on these categories. So it's a much more abstract. The Langlands correspondence then emerges as a kind of an equivalent, as an equivalence between two categories, which commutes with natural functors. And the prevailing wisdom in the field has been that function theoretic, you know, formulation was not appropriate here, or not even possible. This turns out to be wrong. Okay, so before I explain how it turns out to be wrong, I want to go back to S-duality. So 2006, so we are in the language, geometric language is categorical. But around that time, physicists also get interested in categories, A brains, B brains, and stuff like that. And so in the work of Kapustin and Witten, they were able to link the geometric categorical language correspondence for Riemann surface to the S-duality of a certain twist of N equal 4 super young Mills, four-dimensional super young Mills, with gauge groups which are the compact. For me, G is always a complex Lie group, so that's why I put like a little C, meaning compact form, and LG, compact form. On the four manifold, which is a product of the complex curve that the mathematician would consider, and another Riemann surface sigma. And so this, I guess, all of you have seen this before, so I'm not going to talk much about this. But what I want to emphasize is that this S-duality is actually, what is the reason for this S-duality? It's actually has an explanation in terms of string theory. And Kumar and Waffa explained in 98 that we can realize these theories as for non-simple-laced orbifolds, but for simple-laced compactifications, orbifolds off, but for simple-laced just compactifications on dual tori of type 2a or type 2b. String theories, and then we apply T-duality twice for two different circles on the torus. So that's kind of an explanation. In mathematics, by the way, we still don't have an explanation for the Langlands correspondence. It's a miracle. It's a mystery. But you guys have found an explanation. Well, it only remains to understand what string theory is, but you know, if we do, then there is an explanation. So it's a beautiful framework to kind of see where these things are coming from. So now, remember I said that geometric Langlands correspondence is actually correspondence for categories and not functions. But recently, Ettingov, Kasdan, and I were able to formulate an analytic version of this correspondence, building on earlier works by Teschner and Langlands himself, in which, in fact, there is a honest-to-goodness Hilbert space and operators acting on this Hilbert space, so we can have a spectral problem and try to find the spectra of Hecke operators and other operators by using, in terms of the Langlands dual group. In fact, it's very easy to explain to a physicist what the analogy between the two. So you remember how in conformal field theory, we have conformal blocks. So you have conformal and anti-conformals, like chiral and anti-chiral. But these are not physical correlation functions. Physical correlation functions are built as bilinear, or one can say sesquilinear combinations of conformal and anti-conformal blocks. So now, the traditional geometric Langlands correspondence for complex curves is like a chiral story. And it kind of describes conformal blocks. But conformal blocks, they are not, there isn't a single conformal block in general. It's a whole bundle of conformal blocks, you know, with a projectively flat connection and so on. But we can get functions out of conformal blocks by coupling them to anti-conformal blocks. So kind of left and right, coupling them together. This is how we get the analytic Langlands correspondence, the functional theoretical Langlands correspondence out of the traditional chiral Langlands correspondence. Now, Guyot and Witten have given an elegant interpretation of this function theoretic correspondence, also in terms of the S-duality and brain quantization, using some earlier results by Gukov and Witten. Okay, so see that, these ideas of S-duality are extremely powerful in this field. And kind of, we can use them to guide us further and to get more results, both in mathematics and in physics. So, how am I doing on time? Okay, so basically, we have in this new version of Langlands correspondence, the function theoretic version, we actually can have a Hilbert space and commuting operators, and they are of two kinds: there are integral operators and differential operators. And the integral operators are the analogs of the Hecke operators, and the differential ones are the ones which give us the Gaussian Hamiltonians in the simplest case, when the Riemann surface is just CP1. You see. So this general language, think of this analytic Langlands correspondence as a generalization of the Gaudin model, except now, in addition to the holomorphic Gaudin operators, you have also anti-holomorphic ones. And then you do kind of a spectral problem for both of them. Obviously, they commute with each other. And so surprisingly, the result, at least conjecturally, can be described in terms of operas. Remember, we had trivial monodromy operas in the Gaudin model, in the original Gaudin model. Here, there will be operas with real monodromy, with monodromy in the real group, like PSL2R, as opposed to PSL2C, okay? And so, but See, what if we don't want the second set of Gaudian Hamiltonians, the anti-holomorphic ones? What if you want to stay with the chiral story? That can also be accommodated by considering Riemann surfaces over the real numbers, over the reals. So this provides a kind of a unified framework for a large class of Gaudian models, you see? So in all cases, we have this master algebra, the center, and it gives you commuting Hamiltonians in all of these different flavored Gaudian quantum integrable systems of Gaudian type, okay? And each time, the spectrum can be described by some conditions at the singular points, as well as some monodromy conditions. In the simplest case that I started with, it was a trivial monodromy condition. But for other representations, you have other monodromy conditions. It could be, for example, that they are in the upper triangular subgroup, the Borel subgroup, and things like that. So now, I come to sort of the main point, maybe, of this talk, that the modern version of Beta-Ansatz, I would like to suggest, is no longer about finding explicit formulas for eigenvectors. So Feynman was right. He was searching for the source, for the root of this Langlands correspondence, Beta-Ansatz. Because it's just, otherwise, it looks too magical. Like, what's behind it? And what's behind it, I would like to argue, is always a duality. But a duality taken to the limit, where one side becomes classical, you see. So our challenge, then, is to determine what this duality is. For example, in the Gaudian model, this duality is a Langlands duality. And it is a manifestation of S-duality. But you see, in S-duality, you have coupling constant, tau, and then you have minus 1 over tau. So you have this S-duality, or minus 1 over n tau, where n is 2 or 3 for non-simply least. But tau gets, but the coupling constant gets inverted. So we like the coupling constant to be small, but we can also take it very large and kind of take it to the limit when the theory becomes very quantum. And then what happens is that in this very quantum theory, there will be a piece which become classical. That's the center. So that is a phenomenon of the critical level. The theory becomes very quantum when the level goes to, in kind of double, generalized WZW model, when the level goes to minus the Lukoksky number, and things start diverging very rapidly, exponentially, and so on, right? But within the theory, the sector decouples, which is classical, and that one then services the spectrum of the quantum Hamiltonians on the other side. So that's sort of the message. And it's not just an isolated example. There are many deformations now that we know of this story in which a similar pattern holds. Okay? Any questions so far, by the way? Okay. I'm just trying to gauge if I'm going too fast or too slow. Well, I guess soon I will stop guessing because my time will be over. But anyway, so there are obvious deformations, right? So first of all, we have the critical level. But we can move away from the critical level. That's one. That's called quantum Langlands. Then we can stay, or we can stay at the critical level, but replace the Lie algebra by quantized enveloping algebra, quantum affine algebra, or the Jungian. Then we actually go back to original setup of Beta-Ansatz, XXX model, or XXZ model in the case of SL2. So it turns out then the opers become Q-opers. So there is such a notion now of Q-oper, where instead of a differential equation, you have a Q-difference equation. We can also do both deformations. Turn on the level, K plus dual Coxeter number, non-zero, and Q. We get quantum Q-Langlands. And finally, we can go from the affine Lie algebra to double affine Lie algebra. Okay, that's called affine Gaudian model. And opers become affine opers. And the point I would like to make is that in all of these cases, we can observe a similar duality to what I described in the case of Gaudian model. But in most of these cases, we actually don't know what is a string duality which services that. And that is a challenge, I think, for all of us, to try to embed it maybe in some dualities of quantum field theory, string theory, and maybe this way we will get closer to Feynman's dream of, okay. I'm told that I don't have much time, but I guess life is cruel, you know, so sometimes. But yeah, I'm enjoying being with you guys, so, you know. And in any case, I will post this. I'll ask the organizer to post my slides. So maybe let me advance a little bit. It's only 10:54. Okay. All right. Anyway, so yeah, so this may be this important. So there is one more aspect to this. Remember, Miura transformation appeared. Miura transformation is a Hamiltonian map. It preserves Poisson structures. So this actually suggests that there is some Poisson structure built in. And indeed, so this isomorphism I talked about is actually an isomorphism of Poisson algebras. So this is another indication that you can, Poisson means you can deform. So you are at this very weird limit where one theory becomes very quantum, but a classical piece decouples, whereas the other one is kind of normal quantum, you see. But because they have, the other one is classical. The one is classical, the dual is very quantum, but in the dual you get the classical piece decouples. And so, and it services the, it gives you the description of the spectrum. Because it's a Poisson, it has a Poisson structure, you see it can deform. And the deformation actually is very much like T-duality. And this is called the duality of W algebras, where the Langlands dual algebra also appears. Okay, Q deformation. Okay, so this maybe I'll skip. So here we get Q difference operators instead of differential operators, like so. And this lead to the notion of Q opers, ultimately. The Miura transformation becomes a famous Baxter TQ relation. And the T and Q turn out to be transformatrices of this quantum integrable system. And this is for SL2. For general, you have these QIs, which are labeled by the, there are as many of them as the rank of the Lie algebra. And the beautiful fact is that actually they themselves satisfy the system of relations, which have become now extremely useful. And in particular, in the study of applications to N equal 4 super young males, that this QQ system appears in the work of Gromov, Kazakov, Laurent, and Volin, in particular, which gives a very a beautiful description of this anomalous dimensions in for N equal 4 super young males, and much more than that. Okay, so then you have Q opers, then you have quantum Q Langlands. There's a lot of stuff in there. But here again, little string theory, duality in little string theory appears. And I wanted to mention that actually this K plus Gluck-Hochster number can be viewed as string tension, as an analog of string tension, or it connects to string tension, as Maxim Zabzin and others pointed out a while ago. Moving away from the critical level is keeping non-zero string tension. Affine Gaudin models, finally. But now I don't have much time. This is where KDV. So this is where all the things that I set up in the beginning. Remember, we looked at Feynman's blackboard. He was talking about KDV. He was hoping to quantize KDV. So finally, now we can do it. And we can do it in the framework of what's called affine Gaudin models. This is when we go from Lie algebra G to its affine. So from the affine to the double affine, okay? And that's become recently a big area of study. And the dual side, you have affine opers, opers for the dual Lie algebra, dual, but Lie algebra, affine Lie algebra. And QQ system again makes an appearance. And finally, I want to say that now this affine, in the last couple of years, this affine Gaudin models have been applied to specific problems. Some of them mentioned by Feynman, the Kondo problem, as you see on the slide, Gaiota, Ali, Vicedo, and Wu, Kutuzov and Lukyanov, closely related work. Then Costello and others, they were actually, Costello, Gaiota, and Yagi recently were able to interpret the TQ relation in terms of this four-dimensional Chern-Simons theory, where T and Q are the loop operators. Okay, so, and they can reproduce the QQ system, for instance, in this way. Also applications to nonlinear sigma models, which have been always the playing ground of, in the hopes of understanding four-dimensional gauge theories. All right, so what are the open problems? Try to understand this master algebras in more general models, such as affine Gaudin model. Is there a string theory explanation for affine Gaudin models, Langlands duality? I would say this is the biggest, maybe, challenge within reach, that probably within a year it can be Or maybe some in the audience already know how to do it. I would like to know in that case. What if we do both Q deformation and double affine? This, as far as I know, hasn't yet been discussed. And more generally, finally, are there any applications of beta ansatz to the four-dimensional gauge theories like QCD so that Richard Feynman's dream could be fulfilled? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the beautiful talk. We have 5 minutes-ish for questions, either from the audience or...
Oh, I can keep going. I mean... Yeah.
we'll give people a chance.
Okay.
Or anyone online? I don't know. Who is monitoring? Is someone monitoring? Davide is monitoring. Yeah. Davide is also welcome to ask questions based on my knowledge of Davide. Maybe I'll pipe up. I mean, okay, your very last sentence, of course, is extremely suggestive, and we're not allowed to let you go without speculating a little bit more on applications of these sort of techniques to QCD or something like it.
Well, I don't know. I feel that he had something in mind, but he did not reveal it. But we are gradually getting to that point. So far, the kind of four-dimensional gauge theories which have been connected to beta ansatz are supersymmetric theories. So n equal 4 has made its appearance in many ways. N equal 2 also, I didn't have time to talk about it, but Nekrasov and Shatashvili have done a great work connecting n equal 2 supersymmetric gauge four-dimensional gauge theories where, you know, effective twisted superpotential becomes what's called a Young-Young function of an integrable model from which beta ansatz can also be derived. So that's also interesting. But, for instance, it would be very interesting to find something similar in purely bosonic theory. This, as far as I know, hasn't happened yet. But I don't think it's because it's impossible. I think that, in principle, we could try to see that, you know, how that could be achieved. So that's one way in which we could get closer. But also, I think, just understanding more about the origins of the affine Gaudin model, Langlands duality, which Feig and I suggested in 2007, and which is now being used and applied to things like Kondo model that in the works that I have mentioned. So I think there is a lot of work that can be done here to really reach new frontiers.
Thank you. I see we have a question up front.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay.
I was just going to ask if you could say a little more about what you were thinking about the Kondo model.
About?
The Kondo model?
Kondo model, yes. Well, I'm still learning, by the way, so I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert yet, so I'm studying the works of, you know, actually people here at Perimeter Institute seem to be experts in this, so I'm actually hoping to spend some time this week to discuss this and to learn more. But it's interesting to me that Feynman repeatedly mentioned Kondo problem in his, in kind of describing his dream of what he wanted to do, and last year of his life, and so I feel that it's not a coincidence that now we are coming, that we are able to understand some of the aspects of this phenomenon by using the methods of, which could be loosely called the beta ansatz methods.
Maybe there's a question there's, up front, and then if there's anything online.
Would you say that any system which is solvable via the beta ansatz is an integrable system in the sense of spectral statistics?
Is what?
Is an integrable system in the sense of spectral statistics.
Spectral statistics.
Like, you know, Poisson versus Wigner distribution of spacings.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that's not something that I'm aware of, but most likely, yes.
Okay, so then, for example, n equal 4 super Young mills.
Yes.
Would be an integrable model.
Uh-huh.
And then how
it gives rise to some integrable models. I wouldn't say that. Well, you could also, we could talk about by using ADS CFT, you can connect to the ADS 5, which is integrable, classically integrable. That's one thing. But also in four-dimensional super Young mills, one can observe the appearance of integrable systems like XXX when studying the anomalous dimensions of certain operators. So the kind of Hamiltonian naturally appears. In the first one loop, maybe, but perhaps in higher loops as well. So it's not like we are talking about classical integrability there. We're talking about quantum integrability.
Yeah, quantum integrability. Right. And then could you comment about, you know, if you have black holes in the bulk, then we would expect them to be chaotic, I guess.
Probably. So
how,
well, that's
how would that,
that's not exactly my area of expertise, so I don't really have much to say about it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Are there any questions, maybe online? Okay, good. Yeah.
Can you comment on the relation between number theory and complex number timelines?
Ah, right.
Can we get number theory's eigenstatements from complex numbers?
That's a very good question, too. Yes. So David is asking, I talked about Langlands correspondence in mathematics revolving in three different domains, in original number theory and curves over finite fields, and then more recently in a domain of Riemann surfaces, right? And that's it's the last one which connects to quantum physics, to S-duality and things like that, and dualities in string theory. But, so originally Langlands, what was his motivation? His motivation was to actually tackle some specific questions in number theory, you know, like finding, eigenvalues of Frobeniuses acting on the Talcott homology of some elliptic curves. That problem, actually, the solution of that problem called Shimur-Tanyama-Weil conjecture led to the proof of finally to the proof of the Fermat's last theorem. You know, took 350 years to do it in the work of Andrew Wiles and Richard Taylor. So he was motivated by specific question number theory. And a lot of those questions have been solved, but a lot of them still remain unsolved. And so there is always then a question, well, you guys are now doing this theory of a complex curves. In what way can it help us? So actually, it does already help, because there are some methods which appear in the geometric Langlands correspondence which have led to new techniques in the study of the original Langlands correspondence. So for instance, you could study representation of Galois groups and prove that the construct representation of Galois groups, there was a work by Zhiwei Yun, for instance, a few years ago, that he was able to resolve what's called the Serre conjecture, which is constructing representations of Galois groups of number fields whose images are exceptional groups. This was not known. And how did he do it? He imitated the construction that appeared in the geometric Langlands correspondence using opers. So kind of opers helped already in number theory. So in some sense, you know, I guess opers are kind of a big hero of the story. And so we're also hoping that opers will help us to understand maybe more about gauge theory.
May I ask a question?
Sure, we have time for maybe one quick question.
I'm upstairs.
Hi,
Edward. How much of it, of your approaches, can you apply to principal series representations? Not just highest weight, but...
That's right. So this is what I mentioned, but briefly because, of the time constraints. But in my recent work with Ettinghoff and Kasdan, we are specifically about this analytical Langlands correspondence, not only for complex curves, but for real curves. We are able to, it gives a kind of a unified framework in which we can talk about the analogs of Gaudin models, where you take the tensor product not of finite dimensional representation, but say representation of principal series or discrete series and stuff like that. So we actually have a paper coming out soon, I hope, about this. But I'll be happy to discuss it outside, after the talk. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for the great talk. Let's all thank
you. Thank you so much.